You are now listening to our subscriber conference call, exploring the seventh season of Game of Thrones, the show's evolution and the cultural phenomenon it has become. On September 6th, Gilbert Cruz, TV editor, moderated a conversation with two Times culture reporters. After the chat, a few of the 200 subscribers who reserved spots posed questions for our journalists. Visit www.nytimes.com/newsletters/watching to sign up for our TV and movie recommendation newsletter.
Hello. Hi. My name is Gilbert Cruz. I am the TV editor of the New York Times, as well as the editor of Watching, which is our TV and movie recommendation sites. And we're here to talk today about Game of Thrones. I just want to say hello and thank you to all of you subscribers who are joining us today to talk about the show. We really do appreciate your readership, and we're looking forward to hearing from some of you. I think it's important at a time, like an intense news time like this, to sort of also leave space in each of our lives to talk about culture, especially popular culture, and especially a show like Game of Thrones, which is sort of one of the last banner, water cooler, pillar shows that everyone watches at the same time and then talks about the next day. So we're looking forward to it. I'm joined here today by Jeremy Egner.
Hello.
Who writes our weekly Game of Thrones reviews. And Sopan Deb.
Hello.
Who is a reporter in the New York Times' art section. Thank you both for being here today, guys.
Thank you.
Very quickly, before we start talking, a quick programming note about how this will go. Me, Jeremy, and Sopan will talk for a little bit, and then there's going to be an opportunity near the end for listener questions. I urge you to actually ask a question and not offer your opinions, or to offer your opinion and then ask a question. And finally, this conversation will be almost entirely about the show. The three of us respect the books, but we don't really have much experience reading them and won't be able to go into very intense details about the Siege of Pike or other things that are mentioned in the show.
Although I hear good things. I hear good things about the Siege of Pike.
That are mentioned in the show, but not really shown. So it's been more than a week since the finale. I'm going to turn to Jeremy very quickly just to offer a quick verbal recap of what happened in the finale. It's been a while, just to remind us all.
All right, thanks, everyone. So it's been over a week, as Gilbert said, since the big finale, Season 7, which many people liked quite a lot. I liked it fine. I didn't think it was the strongest episode of the season, but I thought it was, you know, exciting in a way and very dazzling in its visually, which most of the season was. But I feel like really what it did is kind of check off a lot of boxes that have been promised throughout, which was, you know, you had Jon Snow and Daenerys finally getting together. They've been making sort of like eyes at each other in the magical cave because, you know, Jon and magical caves, that's kind of his whole thing when it comes to romance. And so they had that happening, and then finally they got together in the finale. You finally have confirmation that Jon is Danny's nephew, because he is the son not of Ned Snow, but of Rhaegar Targaryen and Lyanna Stark, who is Ned's sister. And so that was sort of the big secret that Ned was keeping and protect Jon throughout the course of the show. We all sort of had seen that coming for a long time, but it was finally confirmed, and in the process confirmed that he is the true heir to the Iron Throne, which could create complications for his new relationship. We also had the Stark sisters finally kind of getting together after a year of kind of being at each other's throats. Littlefinger had been manipulating the two of them, as well as potentially Bran, but who could tell what's going on with that guy, because he kind of keeps his own counsel as he downloads the history of the universe. And so they finally got together and executed Littlefinger. And that was, again, something that I think many of us saw coming as soon as he handed off that dagger to Bran, I think in the second episode. Plus, you know, he's been a very enjoyable character, but kind of his time had come to go as the show whittles cast and prepares for the final conclusion and clashes. And the other big thing we had, Dragon Pit reunion fest, in which everybody in the show practically showed up in this dragon pit. And Cersei confirmed that she was not going to go along with this somewhat ridiculous plan to join her enemies just because Jon showed her a zombie. She turned out that she's going to double cross everyone. And that's what's happening going into the finale or the final season. And then finally, we had the Night King with the zombie dragon Viserion, blowing up part of the wall and leading the army of dead. Finally, who's been walking around up there, presumably for the past six or seven seasons, finally through the hole in the wall down into Westeros, which was the big, the clash that has been promised from the start of the show.
So what was his plan if he had not gotten that dragon?
I think this was a problem with the season overall, that there were just so many things that just didn't make sense. And I know that's weird to say in a show that's about dragons and has magic and all this stuff, but even in the reality that Game of Thrones established for itself over the course of the five or six seasons, there are just things that just didn't make sense. Little things like even this season, how quickly it takes to get from one place to the other. Meanwhile, this army of zombies just walking around beyond the wall, just doing what? We don't know.
Stretching.
They're working.
They have a lot of fighting to do.
It's a good point. What were they going to do if they didn't get the dragon? I guess just walk around some more. I just don't know. And I think that was emblematic of a bigger problem with the season, is that just overall, there are a lot of things, whether it was Jon Snow's plan to go capture a white, that there's just a lot of things that just did not make sense in the reality that was established for itself over the course of a couple seasons.
I didn't have as much problems with the sort of logistical issues that lots of people had. There's the supersonic raven at Eastwatch that they sent to get Dany to bring the dragon up to the fight, which ended up getting killed. And, all this sort of timing being sped up in some ways, and people take a day to travel thousands of miles. And meanwhile, we got used to with the show them taking entire seasons to travel a dozen. That pacing part, the pacing issue, and the sort of the logic, logistical stuff was less of an issue. For me, it was about the character stuff. I felt like that many times the story was actually driving the characters rather than the other way around, because I feel like you have people who...
They had to move chessy. They had to move very quickly to get things in place the last, six or so episodes.
So you had people like Tyrion doing things that were out of character, I thought, in order to create the sort of alignment they need for the story, which takes you out of the story.
Tyrion's a great example, by the way. Tyrion, for the first... up until this season, was established as this brilliant, conniving guy that you can't get anything past. Okay, and that's how he survived as a dwarf throughout his entire career, his life. But this season, he's made to be, in essence, an impotent hand of the queen. Okay, he's constantly making bad decisions. And the season ends with him somehow falling for Cersei, saying that she's going to send the army of the Lannisters to the north. This is a guy that has outwitted Littlefinger,
Varys,
had Loras Tyrell under his control because of his brilliance for a while. Led the defense of King's Landing, and how could he be so? How is it conceivable that he would actually believe for a second that Cersei would, here's a dead zombie. You're right. Now you've talked to me in private. We're going to go. I will absolutely send my army up north and leave myself, vulnerable. I just found that what they did with him was just such a disservice to his character. The character they have spent seasons building up.
Right. And I felt like, that was the biggest problem this season was Tyrion specifically. For all the reasons that you mentioned, I could give it some latitude as far as, he clearly has an emotional connection and response to Daenerys. Either he's half in love with her or he's just super inspired by her and he's never had actual feelings. He's been a cynic, his entire life on the show. And so maybe there's something happening there that is clouding his judgment. But as far as the Cersei thing, who he knows better than almost anybody and has sort of spent his life kind of studying and was outsmarting in season two when they were together in King's Landing. Now suddenly, he is a halfwit in her presence and buying, taking at face value, that she is going to do this thing that is totally out of character for her, And so those are the kinds of issues that I had with the season, because that takes you out of the story, right? Which that's what you're here for, is to sort of be immersed and buy into the story.
I really enjoyed the season. I think you guys are crazy. I loved how fast it's gotten. I loved seeing ridiculous and awesome dragon scenes. There was a time when I watched the show in order to have Brienne and Jaime walk for 6 episodes on the road back to King's Landing. And there was a time when, like, the amount of time that passed also added to character development, because you got to learn about those characters, you got to see how they interacted with each other, and the two worked hand in hand. But after 6 seasons, I'm actually very, very fine with the show speeding up. The show can't last forever. It's not Cheers. Even Cheers didn't last forever. Like, the show has to end at some point, and I'm very satisfied with, you know, with where it went. I share some of your concerns about Sopan, about plot holes and stuff like that, but honestly, these are things I thought about after the episode ended, but while I was in it and while I was experiencing the episode, I honestly can't say I was someone that was talking back to the screen saying, this is really dumb, why are you doing this? It was only in retrospect that I experienced those feelings and those thoughts, and honestly, that's fine with me.
Not even when they conceived the plan to go get one of the zombies from beyond the wall.
I didn't think it was the best plan. Well, I didn't think...
They discussed it for a total of like 2 minutes.
And then everybody's totally on board.
No one said, hey, maybe that's not a great idea.
Alternate plan. Give me an alternate plan.
Not that one. I mean, we can't, come on.
All right, we're not making solutions here. Not that saying no is not getting us to where we need to
man.
Be.
I
thought the problem with the pacing this season, it was less about it being too fast, as there were so many revelations sort of baked into it that I felt like for 5 seasons, we were really starving for like, oh, every revelation had all this power. Arguably, like you say, there'd be, the stretches would be too long before we actually got something meaty. And so this season, they just came so fast and furious. You know, there's like one episode, it's like, hey, look, it's Gendry after, you know, 4 seasons. Oh, look, Cersei's pregnant. Oh, and by the way, I looked at the scroll and Jon is Rhaegar and Lyanna were married. So Jon's legitimate. I mean, all these things are happening, you know, one after another. And so it saps the power from each individual revelation. I do think that last season, it really had a nice, it picked up the pace last season, and I think it was kind of at its optimum speed then. This time it was going too fast, I think. There's things happening, you know, one on top of the other. And I also, it made me think back to like, well, you know, instead of having Dany parked in Meereen for 4 seasons, why don't you have some of her story starting longer, you know, earlier, and that way then you'd have this sort of greater mix now. But I think most of the issues that I had with it were just really a symptom of taking this story that had like, you know, 99 subplots at one point and sort of boiling all this down to one in preparation for the next season. So I think that ultimately I feel like I will be more satisfied by next season than I was by this season, because I think there was kind of a, you know, I think I call it the recap shrinking pains this season of getting it all set up for the next one.
What I'm curious, just because I don't want to go totally nego on this season. If you thought, if either of you, other than, you know, the final image of a dragon spewing blue flame or blue ice flame or whatever it was, if there were any moments this season that that you really enjoyed, really resonated with you.
I'm forgetting, I think it was the 3rd episode of the season, which I thought was one of the best episodes of the series, which is when Daenerys finally makes her move and brings the dragon and just goes to town on the.
You mean the terribly titled loot train battle?
We're not calling it the loot train battle here.
The worst.
You know what it's called? I don't know what it's called.
First of all, one thing I'm astounded that Game of Thrones is on television, because it's such a visually dazzling show that those kind of effects are not in a movie, and that they're part of a, you know, a weekly television show is just astounding to me, mm-hmm. because that's a real work of art there. But that episode, I was on the edge of my seat the entire time. And that episode, in particular, I think was what makes Game of Thrones such at best, because it was a show that really focused on, really honed in on one or two storylines at best. Where Game of Thrones is at its weakest is when it has like 6 or 7 different plot lines throughout the show that it has to kind of, you know, go through. But that episode in particular of the season, I thought, was one of its strongest. And it looked like the characters were an actual, main characters were in actual peril. Now, Game of Thrones, in terms of main characters being in peril, that hasn't really been come to fruition in a number of seasons. Not since Joffrey's death, really, that I can think of.
Well, but, it depends on your feelings about Hodor. If you want to, Hodor here in front of God and everyone, that's
right.
You.
No, but I thought that episode in particular was a real strong point because at the end of that episode, I really was on the edge of my seat, like, you know, heartbeat race, and that's when Game of Thrones is at its best, when it really can hone in on one or two things.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and again, I don't want to be sort of put in the chair of the hater, the basher. I'll
never call you that, Jeremy.
I enjoyed this season, and you know, if there's disappointment or dissatisfaction, it was in comparison to the sort of high standards the show has set for itself. I just want to be clear on that. I'm not saying it was a bad season. I just felt like from a storytelling perspective, I felt like it was the weakest season, but conversely, from a sort of visual dazzle standpoint, I feel like it was the strongest. I mean, I thought that the best episode was the one you're talking about, Sopan, which is either the third or fourth Spoils of War, I think is what it was called. And that was sort of an amazing episode, in part because of just like the spectacular visuals, but also because, you know, you get this sense of history within the universe of the show, which is, you see Jaime almost catatonic on the battlefield because he is seeing like the world as he know it change forever. Mm-hmm. You know, this is like the sort of the nuclear weapon arrives, right? And I think that when the show is at its best, it's working on multiple levels, and one of those is it gives you the sense of how history is basically built of like human, you know, strength and frailty and decisions, good and bad. In the way that, you know, we grow up thinking, oh, history is the story that we just memorize, but, you know, it reminds you that, you know, it's happening at all times and it is bending on very human sort of granular decisions. And, so I feel like that was the one episode that was really strong. And you know, I thought there was a great moment when Arya, you know, we saw her kill, Walder Frey last season, but the whole opening scene where she, you know, basically taking out the entire house. It was very satisfying. It was funny. And, you know, a lot of people didn't like the sort of the little finger death scene. I thought it was great because I thought it was very sort of poetic because, you know, Littlefinger is meeting his end in the most sort of like abhorrent way possible to him because he's realizing he's been outsmarted. This is a guy who sort of manipulated the entire story, manipulated every character he's come into contact with more or less. And so for him to finally have that moment of like, I have been outwitted, you know, I thought was very satisfying and brought a nice conclusion to his character. And I thought Aidan Gillen was really, you know, great, kind of like snapped into this sort of poetic, this pathetic groveling mode and was totally believable, you know, as he did it.
Yeah. And the other moment that I thought really worked for me was Olenna Tyrell's death.
Right. Yeah.
That scene.
Because that also felt very on character. Exactly. Yeah.
She's fantastic. Yeah. She was just a fantastic addition to the cast in general. But I thought that entire scene was a great, it wasn't necessarily as much about the plot as much as it was a great, just two actors, you know, ping-ponging with each other very effectively.
Sure.
Olenna Tyrell's death was, I thought, in particular, one that really worked for me. I mean, not that we're in favor of, you know, killing people here, but
it put you in opposition.
Acting-wise, yeah. I thought that really worked.
Jeremy, I think some of our subscribers might be curious, or maybe not. So I apologize if I'm wrong about what it's like to actually cover this show, which some would argue, even if it's not ratings-wise the biggest show on TV, when it comes to the cultural conversation, mm-hmm. whenever it's on, it's all people can talk about. You've been writing about it for The Times for several years now.
Mm-hmm.
What are the different stages that you have to go through in the life cycle of a season to sort of address a show?
Well, you know, it's exciting because it is such a huge cultural phenomenon, really, you know, and so to be sort of at the heart of that is very exciting. I mean, you know, before this season started, I went over to London and spent some time with Lena Headey to write a piece about her. You go to the premieres, all that stuff's very exciting. There's also the kind of the added benefit of like, you know, I haven't been in an awkward cocktail party conversation in probably 6 years because I can just say, oh yeah, Game of Thrones, I write about it. And then I'm good for like the next 2 hours until I sort of make my exit. But you know, obviously Sunday nights our Sunday nights, and you know that too, as the guy who's waiting for me to file these things often, you know, you're sort of up, you're trying to watch closely and process all the stuff that's been, you know, like volumes and volumes of expository dialogue often, and sort of write something somewhat, you know, sensible or entertaining or insightful at best in a pretty quick turnaround. And the other part is just sort of the overarching drawback, to the extent that, you know, writing about a great television show is a drawback in any regard, is, you know, it sort of takes you out of the fan zone and turns kind of this spectacle into work. You know what I mean? So it's kind of like people talk, oh, I can't wait for Game of Thrones. I'm like, oh yeah, it's coming back. You know, so there is that sort of, you know, somewhat desultory kind of aspect to it.
I can't think of a single show that is a weekly event in the way Game of Thrones is. I'm not including reality shows like The Bachelor or like sports events. This is a show that it almost seems one of the rare shows that, me on a personal level, I loved watching on a week-by-week basis as opposed to watching it binge-watching everything at once. This felt like it was the rare show that's kind of like a sporting event in that it was appointment viewing, which I think in 2017 is something that is kind of a rarity. I mean, tell me if I'm wrong.
That's absolutely true. Yeah. I mean, there have been some shows that have popped up. There have been sort of brief flares in the past few years. There was, you know, Empire, for a time, was a show that everyone wanted to watch live and tweet about. Scandal, for a while, was a show like that. This Is Us, arguably, is a show like that. And it's one that has a higher viewership than Game of Thrones. But, you know, you can cover all the shows as much as you want. But you just never see people get as passionate. I think the passionate is the important factor here, about a show they have as they do about Game of Thrones. And not only because what they're experiencing on the screen, but because there's so much sort of extra textual information.
Right.
You know, we started
the book. I mean, there's a whole book series that people were already huge fans of before the TV series.
We started an 8-week pop-up Game of Thrones newsletter because we knew that people really wanted to read as much as they could about the show, but because we also knew that in every episode, you know, as I mentioned before with the Siege of Pyke, there would be things mentioned in an offhand way that you knew almost that the showrunners just like expected that viewers would go search on a wiki, or they would look it up, or they would look to places like us for an explainer. Like, this was a 2-line thing where this character talked about this. What is the history of that from the book? There's just so much there for people to dig into that it really feels like you can actually go down the rabbit hole of this world. There's so many characters, so many countries and families and houses that live on these two continents. It's massive. It's massive in a way that any other popular show, you know, The Walking Dead, just cannot be in the same way.
No. Well, yeah, the density is, I mean, I feel like obviously one of its real strengths, both sort of narratively, like you're talking about, and that you can go as deep into this rabbit hole as you have the time and or desire to do, and there will be another layer. I'm almost positive. I'm sure there's some guy out there who's reached the end and is kind of like, okay, you know, when's the next season happening? But I mean, I feel like you can just sort of go as deep as you want. But then there's also the density just of the sort of story itself, which is, especially in the earlier seasons when we had 80 characters, you know, if you didn't like Cersei, Tyrion would be there, you know, a few minutes. And if you didn't like Bran, then, you know, Arya would show back up. I mean, there's so many different entry points to the show. And then once you got inside, you can kind of, in a weird way, choose your own adventure as far as like who you're going to be most obsessed with, which sort of subplots are you going to be most invested in, et cetera. And so it is kind of, to get back to your original point, it is, you know, the last sort of big tent type show that in that way, and that everybody can kind of get something a little different out of it, but they all can sort of talk about it. Mm-hmm. And just sort of on that, you know, just kind of circle back to what I was talking about a second ago, you know, another benefit of writing about this show so much is we get so much, and I'm not sure if any of our usual regular commenters on the recaps and other things are listening right now, but we get such great input and such energetic, thoughtful, insightful input from so many readers every week on this. It's sort of like, is this instant kind of reward when we write about it, because we know that people are thinking about this as intensely as we are.
I have a few more questions, and then we're going to open up the line to some of your questions, subscribers and listeners. One thing I was curious about, and we were talking about this before we got on the phone, was how the shows, so the show has always been a fantastical series. The first scene of the first episode shows you the White Walkers, and then the White Walkers disappear for a while. But there really has been this marked shift in the past two seasons, this season and last season, from a show that had fantastical elements like dragons and zombies and magic sort of hanging around on the edges, to a show in which those elements are central to the plot and to what's happening. And my theory is that is part of the reason that that the showrunners maybe are flailing a little bit, because they realize like they actually do have to lean into all this fantastical stuff, where before you could have so many scenes of just two people on the road, two people in a room, just character development, conversations, politics, machinations. And now it's zombies, 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 dragons, 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 guys coming back to life.
I think that's a metaphor for what's actually happening. That's in the story, right? Part of the story, what's been at the core of the Game of Thrones story, is that all the stuff that you were just talking about in seasons 1 through 4, seasons 1 through 5, that's that's tangential to the bigger actual problem here, which is the dragon and the White Walkers and all that stuff. I personally am of the belief that I loved watching the non-fantasy part of the shows, because you're seeing the characters actually, win or outwit each other of their own devices, and not needing magic and not being kind of artificially, But to your point, yes, there has been this shift this season, and it has made for some problems, obviously. But that's kind of illustrative of the plot of the show in general, that in this notion that this big thing that's actually the real issue has been kind of pushed off to the sidelines, and now there's been, in essence, a day of reckoning for everybody involved, not just the characters, but also the writers of those characters.
Yeah, I mean, I think the central metaphor of the show is sort of this kind of look, this idea about how the destructive cycles of violence and sort of petty power struggles between people can distract them from more sort of existential issues, right? Whether, and search your own metaphor, whether it's global warming or nuclear, whatever.
Yeah.
You can kind of take what you want out of that. But I mean, I think as far as starting the show with very little sort of magical and fantasy happenings, I think part of that was just smart, right? Because it allows people who think they don't like fantasy to get into the show. And by the time you're pulling out the dragons, then they're already in it and they want to see what's happening.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think you're right. I mean, that there's a scene after Dany saves everybody from during the white fight. And it's like, you have all these bearded dudes and Dany in her awesome winter coat flying on a dragon through this mystical land. I'm like, this is exactly what all your friends who don't think they would like Game of Thrones think Game of Thrones is. It's like, a dragon flying with a bunch of guys and ice spears and magical people. But, I mean, be that as it may, I don't think that just because you're leaning into the fantasy, you don't have to abandon the things that made you so good in the earlier years, which was one reason why I got a little frustrated with the fact that they did pair off Daenerys and Jon, because you don't have to. I mean, that's like the most expected thing. You have two attractive heroes. Let's get them together. Let's get them in a ship's cabin, under some furs. So you don't, but it would have been more surprising. And that was one thing.
So it's so rushed.
Right. Well, I mean, the show used to be, its strengths were like in surprising you and in subverting these fantasy tropes, right? Mm-hmm. The hero of the show, you chop off his head, 9 episodes into it. You have this big clash at the end of season 2, but they're between these two forces and families that are both kind of flawed. You have Stannis, who is like killing his own brother with a shadow baby that he conceived with a Red Witch. And then you have the Lannisters, who are chopping off people's heads and sleeping with each other and, evil, And so it's like, who do I root for in this kind of stuff? When your loyalties are kind of complicated and things are less cut and dry and less very much sort of the predictable story beats of a fantasy tale, it's much more satisfying.
One more question, then we're going to take some thoughts from you listeners. Each of you, please give me one thing you would like to see in the final season, which may come next year or may not come until 2019, which would be crazy if it took that long. But
I'd like a fuller explanation of what Bran is doing. He wasn't used. He was kind of used sparingly this season, and it was a little unclear to me what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
Or what he did. He didn't really put his powers to use in any demonstrative way that I can think of. I would like to see exactly why I should care about Bram's play as the Red Raven, because we haven't really seen that yet.
I would like to see them kill off Danny or John. I think that would be a sort of would get the show back into, it's like, holy crap, I have no idea what's happening. But you know,
but even if they kill off John, the audience won't believe it, right?
Well, so that's,
you know what I mean? But like, so like,
cut off his head.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh,
you can do it in more convincing fashion. You know, a few stab wounds, that's one thing. You don't come back from the beheading.
Okay. Take note.
But you know, the bigger point being that, you know, they say that, you know, there's all sorts of, like, you know, fake out near death moments this season that frustrate a lot of people. You know, my hope is that they're saving all of those folks, whether it be Jorah or Jaime or Tormund or whatever, so that the big battles and big clashes next season have more emotional weight, right? So, you know, I want them to lay waste to the cast, essentially. Not because I'm sort of malicious, but because I think that, you know, it needs to get back into what made it such a captivating story in the first place.
Great. So we'd love to hear from you. Again, a couple reminders, questions, not comments, would be appreciated. We don't know much about the books, and please do keep your questions brief. Okay, first caller.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hey.
How are you? What's your name?
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Hi,
yes.
I'm Doug. I'm calling from Scottsdale. And I'm a total fan. I got a little freaked out when during the abuse of what's her name, but then they finally killed off Ramsay, so that was okay. The one thing I can't wait to see is what the hell they do with Cersei. You know, I can't imagine them keeping her here, but I can't imagine them, how they're going to kill her. We'll see. My one question, and this is kind of retro, I still can't figure out how the Back to the Future moment with Hodor occurred. I haven't seen anything, you know, I haven't seen anything else in the series where something that happened in the future affected what happened in the past. We can see that Bran could see the past, but he hasn't been able to change it. So if somebody could please help me understand that, I'll sleep more peacefully. And thanks
for your
great coverage.
Oh, thank you so much. Thanks for listening, and thanks for calling. We'll try to do that in, like, in 2 minutes. I'm going to leave it to Jeremy.
Well, I mean, you know, I think you did see before the Hodor thing happened, you did see Bran going back into these flashbacks at the Tower of Joy and sort of yelling at his father, and the young Ned seemed to sort of hear Bran. You know, so it suggested that Bran did have that ability to maybe traverse temporal planes, right? And so I think Hodor, and look, this is not gonna, I'm not gonna explain it, the physics of it, just because I don't know it. I'm not sure that they actually exist. but I think the takeaway is that Bran does have the, and one reason we saw Hodor, that thing happen, was to show us conclusively that Bran has the ability to affect other times, whether it's the future or the past. And so I think that's probably something that comes into play in season 6 or season 8. I think that goes to sort of Sopan's point about trying to, you know, hoping to see what Bran's purpose really is. And so as we know now, he can sort of see all directions, time-wise, distance-wise. He can affect different things that are happening in the past and perhaps things that are happening in the future. So how does he bring that power to bear going forward?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Our next caller is calling. Tell us your name and your location.
Hello?
Hi. Hey.
My name is Andrea. I'm calling from Montreal in Quebec. My question was, do you think that Cersei actually thinks she's going to win? Like, or is she just stubborn? I mean, she saw the White Walker and then she's still not, and like, is she even convinced Does she not believe what she saw? I just don't understand what's going on in her mind. I know she doesn't want to like partner with anyone else, and she wants to win the war and everything, and she's really paranoid about that. But does she actually think she's going to win? Like, why isn't she helping them? I just don't understand what she's doing right now.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, Cersei is driven, you know, she talked a lot. I mean, there's irony of the finale, right? Which she made all this noise about, you know, wanting to, you know, secure basically an empire for her family, even as she's like driving all of her family away. So I think it's not, you know, while she's obviously very smart, I think that she might not have a real long-term plan. I think she's playing kind of the short game. And what she knows right now is that if her biggest rivals are fighting zombies thousands of miles away from where she is, she can take advantage of that and then maybe sort out the rest of it later. I'm not sure that she is, and this might be a sort of another, you know, there's some mystery around whether she is or is not pregnant. And this may be, you know, a point in favor of the fact that she's not really pregnant and not really thinking about the future, which I don't know. I don't have any more knowledge than anybody else. But she just seems to be about sort of the next win, right? And so the next win can be the win over the people who are off fighting zombies, and therefore weakened and therefore abandoning their lands for her to take over.
Yeah, I Cersei has shown herself to be, throughout the entire run of the series, a very impulsive character. She's not from even how she handled Ned Stark to how she handled Joffrey. She's always been someone who has assumed that she can take control of a situation. And as you saw with Joffrey, she afterwards finds out that she's unable to control it. I think this is another example of that. And I also am not convinced that her seeing one dead zombie, you know, even it was probably always unrealistic for anyone to think that would convince her to abandon her entire, you know, moral compass to flip that. So this is just another continuation of who's. It would have been more unrealistic, frankly, if Cersei said, you know what, I'm going to change who I am as a person, and I'm going to give you my entire army. You know, I think that would have been more unrealistic.
Right. Well, and as Dany said, she couldn't really understand the scope of it until she saw the thousands of zombies sort of clamoring across the ice. So I think, you know, one zombie, clearly Cersei was shocked by it, but, you know, it's the difference between seeing one and seeing, you know, 100,000. I think it's, you don't really get the best sort of idea of the real plague that's coming down on you.
Yeah, also, she already had a zombie by her side.
True.
She's been protecting her for two seasons.
Yeah, she's out with
zombies. Yeah, I know about this already. thank you very much for your call.
Thank you.
Our next caller is an international caller, so it's a mystery.
Actually, I think it's local. It's Kirsten in Minnesota. And,
God, what are you doing across the table?
Hey, I've got a question. In that finale where we got to see Rhaegar and Lyanna get married, right? Do you think we're going to see more of this in the next season? Are we going to find out why Rhaegar annulled his marriage to Elia Dorne? Why would Rhaegar and Lyanna never like tell people that they're married? And like, why did they let Robert's Rebellion happen? I'm just so curious. That was maybe the biggest surprise for me in the finale, was to get that flashback.
Yeah, I mean, you know, who knows if we'll see more of the flashback itself. If I had to guess, I would guess no, just because I feel like the main point was just to illustrate. It was basically servicing John's story. I think we're just supposed to believe that it was true love, and that, you know, they were willing to risk everything in order to make it happen. And also, yeah, you know, there's spinoffs that are being developed, you know, I guess prequels. So we may see, I wouldn't be surprised if we saw more of like the Targaryen story in one of those prequels. But, you know, anything's possible to show, I believe, but I would be surprised if we saw any more of that particular story. But, you know, anybody disagree?
No, I'd be really surprised if we saw any more. They have so much to get done in the last six episodes.
It's more about just there being six episodes left and a lot to cover.
I'd be really surprised.
I would definitely watch a Robert's Rebellion prequel. So, yeah, like, there's so much there. Like, you keep hearing references to all these different battles, and I would love to see that.
Well, we talked about sort of earlier how the show at its best kind of suggests the sweep of history and how it's sort of based in human frailty in many ways. I mean, that was kind of one of the things that came out of that was, look, this has been told as a heroic tale of, you know, Robert seizing control from a mad king, but really it was just about, a jealous grudge.
Awesome.
Thank you so much for calling.
Great question.
So I guess I have one more question for the two of you, which is how are you going to planning on filling your time this fall now that you don't have Sunday night Game of Thrones obligations?
I'm in the middle of Narcos on Netflix, and I'm very excited for the new Star Trek series coming out. So those are my two things.
Tell us about the new Star Trek series.
Well, it's Star Trek Discovery. It's going to be on CBS All Access. It is the first Star Trek series that is serialized, so it's not every episode gets wrapped up in a bow by the end of it. And other than that, your guess is as good as mine, because they have not given that much out about the plot. And so, I'm excited to watch it. I'm a big Trekkie, and I'm excited to see it.
Jeremy?
Well, I'm looking forward to another HBO show, which is called The Deuce. It's David Simon, George Pelicanos, doing the birth of the porn industry in Times Square in the 70s. That should be a delight. But there's also, David Simon has a good track record. HBO will make it look good, if nothing else. There's also the show called Mindhunter on Netflix, which is David Fincher sort of doing what he does best, which is, delving into, as far as I can tell, there's not a whole lot of information out about it, but it's delving into a psychopath and the person who is trying to catch this person.
Yeah, it's about serial killers, birth of people studying serial killers in the late 70s.
Yeah, it's like another, I guess I will be living in the late 70s this fall. That's the takeaway.
And I am most excited for the Vietnam War on PBS,
yes.
Which is the 18-hour documentary series by Ken Burns. I'm a cliche. I don't know what to say. So I'm looking forward to it.
Top of the Lake looks good, too. That has Gwendolyn Christie in it, speaking of, like, Thrones connections.
Yeah, we'll have an interview up with her going up later today about Top of the Lake. We do have one more caller from New Jersey, hopefully, maybe, and we're going to end on that. In advance of this call, thank you, everyone who called in, who listened, who participated. We hope to do one of these again, not on Game of Thrones, but just pop culture in general at some point in the near future.
Thank you very much, and see you perhaps next year, perhaps 2019, when the Thrones beat resumes.
So one more caller.
Hi, this is Carol from New Jersey.
Carol! Hi, how are you?
Just fine, thanks. Has there always been a three-eyed raven?
Good question.
That is a good question. They seem to have set that up. Right. I mean, I think the one thing that we know has sort of always existed were those children of the forest. They are the ones who created the White Walkers, ostensibly to fend off men. I think the Three-Eyed Raven was another man who lived with the children of the forest, who then at some point became sort of the Obi-Wan Kenobi of the Thrones world. Or Yoda, whichever Star Wars metaphor you want to use. But my sense is that, there is some sort of duality there between the Night King, who seems to have, be all powerful in certain ways, and Three-Eyed Raven, who seems to see everything, and which side of that polarity brand comes down, I think will be one of the things that'll be fun about next year.
Carol from New Jersey, thank you very much for calling.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And again, thanks everyone who participated. Have a great week.
Thanks very much.